Good evening. It is Monday, February 3rd, 2020, and it is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Well, we are in the final phases of the Senate impeachment so-called trial. House managers argued today that senators have a duty to remove President Trump from office as they opened closing arguments in the impeachment trial after last week's vote not to call witnesses regarding the president's conduct towards Ukraine. Senators have been hearing from both the House impeachment managers, led by Representative Adam Schiff, and Trump's lawyers, led by White House counsel Pat Cipollone. The trial is expected to end Wednesday with an acquittal. What has this gotten us? Where has this taken us? For insight, we turn to my first guest. He's a professor of political science at Hamline University and author of Presidential Swing States, Why Only 10 Matter, Professor David Schultz. David, as always, welcome back. So when all of this started, the accepted narrative was that Speaker Pelosi had allowed herself to be taken down an unwinnable rabbit hole. Maybe now the Democrats are redefining win. They did put on a pretty good case. No conviction, but a lot of damaging dialogue. Are there more people listening to this than originally expected? And basically, my opening question, where has this gotten us and where is this taking us?
So when Nancy Pelosi was first became Speaker of the House, she was confronted with the question, should they impeach Donald Trump? And she said he wasn't worth the bother. And in many ways, she was goaded into the impeachment process, both by her majority and also by events that Donald Trump did in terms of going after Joe Biden. Now, if one views the idea of saying that the impeachment is a success in the sense that they impeached him, they probably tarred and feathered him, and some damaging information is coming out about him, then yes, it's a success. If you define success as removing him from office, no one ever expected that that would occur. So somewhere the impeachment process, in terms of from the Democrats' perspective, is really a little ambiguous. You know, they made some points, they got some information out. But at the end of the day, I think the whole purpose of this impeachment was A, to try to make a point, and B, to try to damage the president significantly for the 2020 election. And in terms of the latter, it's obviously too soon to tell.
The jury is definitely still out on that. It's interesting because impeachment does not seem to be resonating. When you listen to, for example, the dialogue, what's being discussed in Iowa, as today is the beginning of the Iowa caucuses, impeachment does not seem to be high up on anybody's list.
So you're absolutely correct, is that if viewership on television or through the media is an indication of interest, it's not been a runaway smash hit in terms of people listening to it. And again, if one looks at public opinion, it's pretty much divided, not a surprise, between Democrats and Republicans and how they view the president. But if we look at the needle, if we look at how during the last several months of the House impeachment hearings and the Senate trial, to what extent has it affected, let us say, the approval rating or the disapproval rating of the president, or affected his standing in the polls? At best, it's had almost no impact, maybe a point here or there. And so you can't really say right now that it has done much to move the American public. And I think the American public, except for probably a half a dozen people, I say that in jest, have made up their minds about Donald Trump in terms of what they think. And it's all really going to come down to how does all of this information, how does this entire process play, if at all, in the November 2020 elections, which are still, 9 months away.
There were Republicans that were trying to get this thing wrapped up before tomorrow, since tomorrow evening the president delivers his State of the Union. And now he will not be able to go into the chamber declaring that he has been exonerated because the trial won't end until Wednesday. Of course, we know it's hard to predict what the president will say. Bill Clinton, when he gave his State of the Union at a similar point in his administration, he did not mention impeachment. It'll be interesting to see or listen to and see whether or not the president mentions this tomorrow or if he takes the advice of sage counsel and says, you need to let this one go.
Yeah, it's going to be tough for Trump. You know, Bill Clinton was a fairly disciplined speaker. Trump is not as disciplined, known for good or for bad to go off script a lot. I can't imagine how he wouldn't feel the need or want to say something, because every event that he gets a chance to appeal to his base, every event that he gets a speaking opportunity to be able to beat up on the Democrats or Nancy Pelosi, he uses it. So this will be very hard for him. And I think what the Democrats are sort of hoping on right now is that he implodes during the State of the Union speech in terms of what he says. What I'm going to be curious about is how many people are actually watching that State of the Union speech. And if they are, is it like watching, waiting for the train wreck, people hoping that he'll do something or say something bad, or if you're a supporter, that he'll go after the Democrats. So I just don't know what it's going to be, but I think the temptation for him not to say something is too powerful.
Let me switch gears, and I'm going to throw something at you that I didn't ask when we invited you on today to focus on talking about. But the Democratic National Committee is now changing the rules to allow Michael Bloomberg to enter the debates. And I wanted to get your take. This, to me, seems to be desperation on behalf of the Democrats. It also seems, since Bloomberg is a millionaire and has not followed the standard procedure up to this point, this really seems as though, A, the Democrats are desperate. They see that Joe Biden will not be able to prevail. They're desperately trying to find an establishment candidate that they can rely on. It seems as though they're putting their money on Bloomberg, and this also seems to me to be class warfare. Your thoughts?
Oh, I agree. The only suggestion I would correct you on is, remember, Bloomberg is a billionaire, not a millionaire.
Oh, thank you. Oh, how très gauche of me.
Yeah.
No, you're absolutely right.
Yeah. I think he's only worth $55 billion.
My mistake.
Yeah, but no, I think you're right, because the criticism is actually coming from several scores. One of them is the fact that these rules are changed after what? All the candidates of color have been basically forced out of the race, mm-hmm. which is one issue. And two, you're right, it's looking increasingly like in Iowa and in New Hampshire, Bernie Sanders is in the lead or is prevailing. Joe Biden, while he still has quite a bit of support, it's not an enthusiastic and deep support where people are really excited about him. So I think we're exactly seeing a situation where the Democrats are A, recognizing the reality that Bloomberg, with his billions, could be a potentially very powerful candidate. And B, I think it's also a worry move in the sense that if they do proceed with Bernie Sanders going forward, there's a lot of Democrats, Perez, who's the head of the DNC, and many others, that guess what? That they think that the Democrats are going to go down badly to Donald Trump. So Bloomberg becomes what? Their savior.
Let's see how all of that. Oh, you know what? One other thing just popped in my head. As I was watching the Sunday talk shows, the narrative as it relates to Biden in Iowa seems to be changing. Up until, say, last week or so, it was presumed that Joe Biden would win Iowa hands down. Now, as we see the surge of Bernie and well beyond the margin of error in a number of polls, it seems as though Bernie's going to walk away from Iowa and walk away from Iowa the victor. Now I'm hearing people say, oh, well, Joe Biden doesn't have to win Iowa. All Joe Biden really has to do is have a very strong showing in Iowa, and that'll just be fine for Joe going into New Hampshire. Have you noticed the change in narrative, and do you see that as a very subtle admission that Joe's not doing well?
Yeah, it's clearly, it's the expectations game. Iowa is less about real performance than it is about what anticipated versus realized performance. And everybody was saying Biden should win this one, Biden should win this one. Much like 4 years ago, they said Clinton should win this handily. And Clinton essentially was tied with Sanders. Here now, everybody's preparing for what's probably going to be, unless we're completely surprised, Biden coming in second or third. And so it's that lowering of expectations, lowering the expectations probably also for New Hampshire, when he meets those lower expectations, people can say he's still a viable candidate. But clearly, it's a recognition of the fact that Biden is not a strong candidate. He is the candidate that people will go with because he seems to be safe, but he's not the candidate that too many people seem excited about.
Professor David Schultz, as always, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate your analysis. Look forward to having you back.
Good to talk to you all. Thank you. Bye.
Thanks, David. All right, folks, you are tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Senator Bernie Sanders, the independent from Vermont, was the standout Democratic presidential fundraiser of 2019 with 1.4 million donors from across the country. Sanders, who is surging in the polls as Iowa's caucuses open today, entered 2020 with at least $18 million, many more than of his Democratic rivals who are not self-funded billionaires. The polling numbers I've seen have him up by 4 to 7 points, depending on the particular poll you look at, all of which are outside the margin of error for the polls. What's going on in Iowa? Well, for that, we turn to my next guest. He's the producer of By Any Means Necessary, heard here every day on Radio Sputnik. He is Bob Schlehuber. Bob has a report that he filed from Iowa. We'll listen to that, and then we'll go live to Bob.
It is my distinct privilege and honor to introduce the next president of the United States, Bernie Sanders.
Iowa's Democratic caucus Monday will mark the start of Bernie Sanders' second attempt to take on the Democratic establishment and upset longtime party members by becoming their party's nominee. But unlike in 2016, when Sanders ran for president the first time, he heads into Monday night's caucus as the clear frontrunner. And unlike in 2016, when he faced just one opponent, Hillary Clinton, this year he has a much wider field of Democratic challengers to contend with.
Would you please get off your feet and welcome Matt Pete to be your next president of the United States?
Your next president, Elizabeth Warren!
And if that's not enough, Sanders has to once again take on the governing institution of the primary process, the Democratic National Committee, who in 2016 was charged with rigging the election in favor of Hillary Clinton. Just this week, the DNC has announced their convention committees, the committees that set the rules and party platforms at their national convention, would be full of former Obama and Clinton insiders who have spoken out openly about their disdain for Sanders. The DNC also unexpectedly changed their debate qualifying rules to easily allow for billionaire and former Republican Mike Bloomberg to participate in upcoming debates. With these moves, it's clear America's elites and ultra-rich are panicking.
It's so amazing to see the wealthy, the 1%, going crazy on TV this past week. They don't know what to do. They never expected this to happen. Here we are just before the Iowa caucus, and Bernie Sanders is number one in the polls in Iowa.
That was filmmaker Michael Moore speaking to an energized crowd of over 3,000 people in Des Moines, Iowa on Saturday night at a Sanders rally. The filmmaker, along with public intellect Cornel West, Congresswoman and squad member Ilhan Omar and the band Vampire Weekend all spoke to the need for Americans to abandon capitalism and embrace Sanders' call for socialism. For them, the banner of socialism was a winning issue. For others, like former presidential candidate U.S. Congressmember Tim Ryan, it was another way to attempt to scare voters away from Sanders.
To run under the banner of socialism, I mean, do we not think Donald Trump is going to campaign against him under that, with that attack line? And then you're talking about taking people's health insurance away. Like, that connects really easily for people. And I'm just very concerned that's a dangerous position for us to be in at a time where we need to get him out of there.
Ryan has endorsed Democratic establishment frontrunner, former Vice President Joe Biden. This doesn't seem to bother Sanders, though, as he readies himself against the Democratic establishment and many others.
We are taking on the entire political establishment. Both the Republican establishment and the Democratic establishment. We are taking on Wall Street and the insurance companies and the drug companies and the fossil fuel industry and the military industrial complex.
And Sanders supporter Tony, a 30-year-old phlebotomist for the American Red Cross, thinks there's enough people ready to take on that fight with Sanders.
In 2016, the DNC made a mistake. They gave us the wrong candidate. And I think enough people are out now to show the Democratic Party the only way to win is to have the right candidate this time and not just give us the establishment.
Iowa's First in the Nation caucus looks to be the start of what will be a long, bloody fight within the Democratic Party.
Bob, great report. Bernie enters Iowa the clear frontrunner, as you mentioned in your report, but not the party establishment favorite. What does this say to you about the divisions within the party and what appears to be a disconnect between the party establishment and their base?
Yeah, two things. I mean, this is the Democrats' own making for decades now. They want to be the party of the big tent, and their big tent expanded. In its rhetoric, and now they found themselves with the big tent and have a lot of people under that tent that they don't necessarily fit into what they had in mind of what the Democratic Party should look like and some of the values it should stand for. And it surely wasn't looking for a socialist like Bernie Sanders, of whatever you think that word socialist may mean. I think it's another conversation. I don't think they ever expected somebody like him coming into their party and kind of wrestling it away from them. And it's pretty clear when you go to these different events that at the Bernie Sanders rally, you have a much different crowd of people. It's very diverse for what Iowa white diverse means here, but it looks much different than the other rallies that I attended over the last few days. And it'll be really interesting to see if Sanders is able to capture the nominee. A lot of people said that they'll support him regardless, and Donald Trump being out of office is more important above anything else. But what that looks like will be really interesting.
And that's interesting to me because this seems to be the opposite, or there seems to be the opposite happening in the Republican Party. Many say that this is now the party of Trump and that people are pandering, Republicans are pandering to the base, but the base does not represent the sentiments of mainstream America.
Yeah, and if you look at it in one way, if you want to tie together the corporate U.S. media, the CNNs, the MSNBCs, the Fox Newses of the world together, the last 2 weeks has been nothing but wall-to-wall coverage of the impeachment trial of Donald Trump. Here in Iowa, impeachment is not being talked about. It's not being mentioned by the candidates. It's not being included in the questions and answers after the stump speeches. When I interview people about what issues they care about, impeachment's not here. And if that doesn't say how out of touch the corporate media is, and then the corporate owners of those media who do support both the Republican and Democratic establishments and fund their parties, it shows that there's a huge disconnect that's currently taking place. And if the Democratic Party wants to win back the White House, they're really going to have to appeal to the grassroots that I think Barack Obama last did for the party. It's much different than what Hillary Clinton's race looked like as she lost several key states as she was accused. And obviously she didn't go to many of those states of not doing enough to reach out to the grassroots. And now here you have a grassroots candidate. And again, in Bernie Sanders' rally that I went to that you heard from the clip, he had what looked like a grassroots. You had union workers, you had medical students, you had retired folks, You had grunge rockers with green hair. You had people that were dressed rather nicely in nicer clothes. For whatever all that means, it just looked and felt like the grassroots organization and coalition you would need, along with the huge volunteer numbers that they have both in Iowa and beyond. That as the Democrats want to win back the White House, they might have to go with the candidate that they least prefer.
Great, great point, because now we're starting to hear discussions about kitchen table issues, and that the Democrats are going to have to start talking about kitchen table issues, which for the most part seems to be what Bernie has been talking about for a very long time. But with that being said, are the Democrats having a problem with the message or with the messenger, or a combination of the two?
It felt a lot like the message for a lot of the Democrats was more just, hey, this is who I am. This is what we're looking at. Things are broken. Let's fix it. And credit to Bernie Sanders, he did not pull back from any of those issues he's been talking about. He does have the longest track record of running for president out of this current field. I mean, Biden ran twice before, but they were short-lived races. That people know who Bernie Sanders is. And I think the advantage there is he says, hey, you already know who I am. Here are the issues, and let's drive them forward. And didn't shy away from them. The difference there with Elizabeth Warren or a Pete Buttigieg is they're still introducing themselves to a lot of people. It's still about their kind of personality that they're not yet able to pivot to those kitchen table issues, as you say. And it was interesting hearing Elizabeth Warren. She really shied away from really going deep into what exactly she was talking about when she talked about racial inequality. She said racial inequality exists, but what is it exactly? And then you have a Bernie Sanders that says, no, it's a private prison. It's the military industrial complex. It's the screwed records on marijuana convictions. It's the billionaires in the top 1% that are coming after you. And you can feel a different kind of energy from the campaigns. It seems plenty early right now. I don't know if candidates are having to pivot to the kitchen table issues yet until it's maybe down to one or two, or maybe even just three candidates. Still right now, people need to remember it's a name recognition game. A lot of people in Iowa and the smaller towns that I just stopped in at the bars just to get a feel of what was going on didn't even realize there was a Democratic caucus. A lot of people obviously aren't Democrats, and a lot of people are only targeted if they're expected to be in the caucus. So you still have a long way to go of name recognition for the Democratic nominee, and a lot of them building out their platform of what it's going to look like. And I still think it's relatively early. As long as the media has been covering the campaign, it's still rather early in the process in a lot of people's minds.
As Garland Nixon says here on Fault Lines with Nixon and Stranahan, he talks about Bernie. Well, he talks about the Democratic establishment proposing temporary fixes as opposed to Bernie, who in many instances is providing long-term solutions. And that to me, and I think Garland's right on that point, and that also says to me that the Democrats still don't understand the message and what really will resonate with voters in this country. And so what we have in terms of this so-called two-party system, we have in many instances Democrats proposing policy that are really distinctions without differences.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it is just the political imagination of so many people. You do have a sizable number of Democrats in the state of Iowa, at least, that would accept a left-leaning socialist nominee. I think it was roughly 50%, 56% in the poll that I saw. And you've seen huge balloons in numbers of organizations like Democratic Socialist of America since 26. They went from some 5,000 members to nearly 60,000 members. So you have a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters that are on board with socialism, or at least the idea of socialism. What it looks like is still up for debate. What Bernie Sanders now has to do, if he ends up being the nominee or over the next few months, is to better help people understand what socialism is, and that it's not a deviation from what is already, in many instances, already part of their lives. But so many people could not imagine a public health care option, could not imagine socialism, yet they have Medicaid, they have Medicare, you have Social Security, you have a military that is wholly funded by their taxpayer dollars, which is socialized for their protection. Even in the state of Iowa, where the Department of Agriculture and agriculture plays such a huge role in their economy, the Department of Agriculture was founded in socialism in the 1930s and is an integral part of these people's lives. But yet, because of the way in which socialism has been presented over the last several decades in the American populace, a lot of people are still blocking themselves from fully accepting what Bernie Sanders could mean for their daily lives. And that will be the ultimate test, I think, for Sanders, is to really hook those people in a better understanding of what he is trying to offer and then turn them into a large volunteer coalition that can win the presidency for him come November if he is the nominee.
And to your point, Bob, what were the subsidies that the Trump administration provided to many farmers, many of them who are in Iowa, to offset their losses from his silly trade war with China? What was that other than socialism? That takes me to the point. Yesterday, as I was watching some of the Sunday talk shows, I think I was watching Meet the Press, and the question was asked, how do the Democrats deal with the tag of socialism? And I was amazed at the lack of depth or imagination from the respondents, because no one said, well, first of all, what we probably need to do is educate the electorate to let them know that this isn't socialism. And nobody said that. And I found that to be amazing. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, Bernie Sanders has already come out and gave his "What is Socialism?" speech, and I think it fell pretty flat. And so I think, it's really going to be on him to educate the masses of people. But it was really frustrating talking to a Congressmember Tim Ryan there in the package that I presented there to you, of somebody that says, look, I'm down there with the workers. I know the workers need more rights and we got to get them better stabilized in the economy. And you're saying to the guy, well, what's it mean to fix capitalism? And everybody just kind of assumes, oh, fix capitalism means something. And if it meant anything, it would be redistributing some of the wealth and the control of the companies to those everyday factory workers. And that is what a brand of socialism, I think, that Bernie Sanders is offering. I don't think he's offering socialism in the classical sense of complete state-run factories across America, but at least he's talking about more equitable pay for workers. So you would want to ask a lot of these pundits who just kind of easily dismiss socialism, well, what exactly does it mean to fix capitalism? And I surely don't think they would have a good answer on that.
One of the clear examples of this, in my humble opinion, would be just looking at the economy and the fact that the U.S. economy grew in 2019 at 2.3%. The economy in China grew at close to 7%. The economy in India grew at close to 7%. And we listening to mainstream analysts here, 2.3 American growth. Oh, that's some kind of stable, great number. But that's based upon consumer spending, and most of that based on credit. It's not based upon reinvesting into the economy by the businesses that are making all of this money. To talk about fixing capitalism and what's wrong with socialism, this, I think I can put together a pretty good explanation just based on the growth numbers from last year.
Yeah, and there's something to be said about that redistribution of wealth. I mean, Andrew Yang, what a political dark horse. Someone that's never ran for office, not getting necessarily huge numbers at his events, but everyone you talk to is really impressed by him, really likes the guy. And universal basic income, for all of the flaws of not offering a true safety net or a true fix in people's lives, really does appeal to people. So if Bernie Sanders can try to find kind of a path that talks about redistributing wealth to people that allow them to make their own choices, which I think he is talking about, I think that would resonate with people, kind of like an Andrew Yang out of nowhere has been able to capture people's imagination. Again, it's just going to be a matter of framing for Sanders if he can better present what he's talking about, socialism and breakthrough, and have to fight off the corporate media, like you said, who has very little desire to do a deep analysis of what they're talking about or what Sanders is talking about and offering. But if he is able to do that, I think you could see a large political movement at least to go head to head against Donald Trump come November.
Bob, final question for you. There's been, for months, there's been all of this conversation about whether or not Bernie can win, whether or not Bernie can't. Joe Biden, for so long, has been the presumptive Democratic nominee. Now, just over the last 2 days or so, I've been starting to hear the change of the discussion. Now, all of a sudden, Joe Biden doesn't have to win Iowa. Joe Biden just really has to have a strong showing that will carry him into New Hampshire. What is your sense on the ground? Are you getting the sense that I'm getting that Bernie's going to win Iowa and that that's going to really cause a problem for the other Democratic candidates?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite interesting to see how polls and history repeat itself. The same thing in 2016 in August or June, July, the summer before the February caucus. Sanders was down 30, 40 points. And we said the same thing in August of this year. We went to the Iowa State Fair and you're on the ground talking to people and you're saying, man, these polls are doing the exact same thing. He's down double digits to Joe Biden. And it doesn't feel like that at all. And sure enough, he's closed the gap. He's actually ahead. He was only ahead of Hillary Clinton by a poll, I think, in 2016. And then he basically tied, lost by a few points there on caucus night. Tonight he goes into the caucus leading the polls. And so I think that's really important. I think the way in which the next primary, New Hampshire, and then you have Super Tuesday on March 3rd, you have two debates in between there. The candidates have quite a bit of name recognition and cash still on hand that I think as long as everybody can kind of move the goalpost and spin tonight as win. I mean, Howard Dean got third place in Iowa when he ran here and he somehow spun third place as a win. And Michael Dukakis did the same thing. He said, hey, we were just shooting for the bronze medal and the media ate that up. So I think right now it's just kind of a story and a narrative and a spin that people will leave Iowa with. Tonight, it's not an election and people need to remember this is not an election. This is a caucus. It's people in a large room. It's just kind of getting a pulse on things. You have people will shift allegiances if their candidate isn't qualified. And it's a much larger field than what will actually be there when you get down the road in a month or two from now. So it really kind of just how you spin tonight. And if Joe Biden wants to spin tonight as a second or third place is a win for him in the books, then he's going to spin it. And I'm sure the media will eat it up and still kind of quiet. Sanders wins but loses will be the headline if he wins tonight, tomorrow for a lot of the mainstream media. So I wouldn't read too much into the first Iowa caucus, but just kind of a gauge of what the temperature here is in one state heading into a really busy next month here.
And this now truly is my final question. The DNC has changed the rules. You mentioned the two debates. The DNC now has changed the rules to allow Bloomberg into the debates. A, they really seem to be setting up Bloomberg because Biden is waning in the polls, and this then will also start to look like class warfare.
Yeah, I mean, even John Kerry was caught allegedly talking on the phone by an NBC analyst reporter talking to somebody about what it would take for him to get into the Democratic race. And it was interesting. He very vehemently denied that that happened. But at the rally I went to last night, John Kerry went from talking on stage before Joe Biden and even introducing him at several rallies to just being sidelined as just kind of a waving participant from the crowd. So the Democratic establishment internally will trip over itself and I think really start eating itself up and embarrassing itself if they're trying to do something for a brokered convention or trying to take the race from Sanders. It already doesn't look good with what they've done for Mike Bloomberg. Obviously, if you're a Cory Booker, if you're a Julian Castro, a Tulsi Gabbard, and you're now hearing that the number of grassroots donors doesn't matter anymore to get into these, those candidates right there, Julian Castro could be a rising star within kind of a acceptable left wing of the Democratic Party. He's got to say, screw you guys. You want me out there stumping for your eventual nominee and you are doing things like this. They could try to take this from Sanders, but it's really going to cost them quite a bit, I think, in the process.
It would take an awful lot of guts for a Julian Castro or any of the others who have fallen out to balk the party establishment because they're party establishment.
Yeah, and it was John Kerry, too. But the fact that John Kerry thinks he's the guy that America's going to turn to in a moment of panic from Bernie Sanders, you got to be kidding me.
Bob Schlehuber, producer of By Any Means Necessary, joining us live from Iowa. Thanks so much. Safe travels. We look forward to talking to you tomorrow.
Appreciate it.
All right. All right, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. According to my next guest, as coronavirus spreads, so does anti-Chinese racism. Similar to how Ebola was racialized as a distinctly African illness, news of the coronavirus has led to an outbreak of anti-Chinese sentiment across the West. This is the title and subtitle of my guest's latest latest article in Mint Press. He's a staff writer for Mint Press News. After completing his PhD in 2017, he published two books, Bad News from Venezuela, 20 Years of Fake News, and Misreporting and Propaganda in the Information Age, Still Manufacturing Consent. Dr. Alan McLeod, as always, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
So give us some insight. I mean, this is an incredibly, well, first of all, this anti-Chinese racism isn't really being well reported here in Western media. Give us some idea of what motivated you to write this piece.
Yeah, sure. So obviously the coronavirus emanates from Wuhan in central China. There's now more than 10,000 cases that have been confirmed, a few hundred deaths as well. But with the spread of the virus, there's also been a sort of panic, a yellow peril over the potentiality of being infected by Chinese people. And this is happening all over the world. I saw it first on social media where, for instance, James Corden, the popular entertainer, posted a photo of himself with the Korean pop band BTS. And the top comments, which got 25,000 likes, was that James Corden dies of the coronavirus. So it's this idea that you can't go near Chinese people. Chinese people are contagious. They're infectious. This is happening all over the world, even though, for instance, BTS is actually a Korean band. We've also seen Chinese children being reported that they're being bullied in school in Canada and the UK. And in general, Chinese businesses have suffered very badly. For instance, restaurants in France and Italy have reported that they've had 50 or 60% reductions in the amount of people visiting. So all around the world, this this coronavirus has been coded as a sort of the Chinese bug and has opened up some rather nasty undertones that have always been there in Western society.
Talk a little bit about the old stereotypes of the yellow peril. You have in your article, one French newspaper printed the headline, Yellow Alert, on its front page, suggesting the country was facing a new yellow peril.
Well, for instance, in the U.S., there was a wave of Chinese immigration in the late 19th century. Chinese people were critical in actually building up the infrastructure of America. But there was always a serious distrust of them. And with when they started coming to the U.S., there was always this sense that in popular culture that the Chinese were somehow different to white Americans, that they brought diseases with them. It's actually quite similar to the sorts of stereotypes and slanders we hear against Latinos crossing the border today. When China turned communist in the 40s and 50s, this changed into a more sort of, we've lost China, Chinese people can't be trusted, they're scheming, there are adversaries. And this sort of generalized anti-Chinese hostility continues low level to this day.
You know, you made, I think, an incredibly poignant comparison, or I don't know other way to describe it. You can inform me, where you talked about if Americans are worried about potential outbreaks of disease, they need not look as far afield as China. A poll published yesterday revealed that over 40% of the country does not always wash their hands after using the bathroom. Meanwhile, a new report released last week found that dozens of major cities' drinking water, including Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, New Orleans, and Miami, have been found to contain toxic cancer-causing chemicals. So your point is, it's very, I guess your point, and you can correct me, it's very easy to look at and point the finger at China, but we don't have to go too far within the United States to find we got larger problems than this coronavirus.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, obviously, the coronavirus is a serious, serious problem for the Chinese government to deal with. But there are equally important cases that the U.S. government could look at. The coronavirus, because it's new, garners headlines. But, you know, just regular flu has killed thousands of people in the U.S. already. I saw one report that said perhaps 10,000 people have died of the flu this winter. And as you said, there are dozens of American cities with terrible quality water, which new reports have found to contain carcinogenic chemicals. They contain forever toxins. That's the word they use. These particles, which are incredibly difficult to get out of the water supply. And yet the Trump administration has just effectively gutted the EPA last week, removing all sorts of protections that Nixon put in place in the early 70s. So we could look at China to say they've got some problems, but frankly, perhaps we should be looking closer to home.
In fact, to that point, as it relates to the export of or the import, depending on which side of the equation you're looking at, of American beef, Japan, China, Britain, and France have all been concerned about importing American beef because of the chemicals, the steroids, the growth hormone that has been injected into American beef. And instead of the United States taking what I would consider to be a sensible, reasonable approach, when, for example, France wanted to ban the import of American beef, the United States, I think under the Bush administration, raised the tariffs on Bordeaux wine and Roquefort, I think it was Roquefort or blue cheese. And so instead of dealing with the problem, we just saw this as a trade war issue, and we just raised tariffs on products coming from those countries instead of checking to be sure that the concerns that these countries have aren't reasonable concerns.
Yeah, and they absolutely are. You know, we should really be collectively making moves to make sure that if we're going to eat meat, at least be clean and free from things like hormones, estrogens, for instance, which other countries have decided that they don't want in their products at all. And if the European Union, for instance, is banning a process that the U.S. is practicing because of its health implications, we should really start to look at that and say, why are they doing this? Maybe we should be doing the same. Surely Americans deserve the same quality beef as Europeans do.
And there's also now an issue with, and this goes a little beyond your particular piece, but you did mention this in our conversation. This virus is threatening U.S. companies' supply chain, as so many products and parts and materials are made in China. The battle to contain the Chinese coronavirus threatens to cut off U.S. companies from parts and materials they need to produce iPhones, automobiles, and appliances and drugs to treat medical conditions, including Alzheimer's disease, high blood pressure, and malaria. So this is having an economic impact, and the economic impact at this point is relatively small, but depending on how far this virus grows, if it continues to grow, this could have a dramatic impact on the economy.
We live in a globalized world, and China is the workshop of the world. 30, 40 years ago, most of this stuff would be made either in Europe or the U.S., but now the first world imports its stuff from China, from India, almost exclusively. And so that really does raise questions that if this virus does continue to grow, unfortunately, some news is coming out that perhaps the contagion level of the virus is already on the wane. If it does continue to grow, that will certainly raise a lot of serious questions about the economic supply of the world, how products are moved around the world, and how dependent we are on China for all sorts of things that make daily life possible.
And major airlines in the U.S. and Europe, they're halting their cargo and passenger flights to China for up to 2 months. Recent visitors to the country, they're barred from entering the United States. So we've got automakers, we've got General Electric, Caterpillar. I mean, to your point, this could have a devastating impact if this thing continues to grow.
Yes, I mean, it's difficult to really predict these things, but virtually every large company in the West is, to some extent or another, dependent on Chinese labor in one form, either if it's directly employing people or subcontracting to other businesses. So certainly the consequences of this could be manifold.
Dr. Alan McLeod, as coronavirus spreads, so does anti-Chinese racism. This great piece can be found at mintpressnews.com, at mintpressnews.com. Alan, as always, thank you for your time and look forward to having you back on the Critical Hour.
Sure. Anytime, Wilmer.
Thank you. All right, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. In wake of Trump-Netanyahu proposal, the so-called deal of the century, Palestinian authorities cut ties with the U.S. The Palestinian Authority, which governs the occupied West Bank, announced on Saturday that it would act immediately to cut ties with the U.S. after President Donald Trump unveiled his so-called peace plan that effectively allows Israel carte blanche to continue the occupation and theft of Palestinian land. What does this mean, and will this action by Mahmoud Abbas, president of the Palestinian Authority, really matter? For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's a co-founder of Black Alliance for Peace and former vice presidential nominee for the Green Party, Ajamu Baraka. Ajamu, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
According to Reuters, the Arab League foreign ministers meeting in Cairo said the plan would not lead to a comprehensive and just peace, and that the League would not cooperate with the United States in implementing it. Foreign ministers from Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Iraq, Lebanon, among others, said there could be no peace without recognizing Palestinian rights and a comprehensive solution. So, this is not just Abbas operating in a vacuum. What does this say to you?
Well, it says that there are some major contradictions and some political games being played. We might recall that when Trump announced his so-called deal of the century, a number of those same Arab states, the Saudis, the Egyptians, UAE, they said that they accepted the general framework. But what happened was, as a consequence of the response from the populations of their own nations and really across the planet, they had to back up and take a more reasonable and historically correct position that you have to look at the rights, you have to center the rights of Palestinians, you have to have a plan that more accurately represents a real possibility of peace as opposed to an imposed peace and a de facto annexation of occupied territory. So, you know, these are some of the political games being played. And I think the Trump administration is, I think they are counting on the possibility of the same states that claim to be in opposition to the plan at some point coming on board and supporting.
When I look at the list of countries in the Arab League, particularly Egypt and Saudi Arabia, to your point, the leadership in that country is adjusting its position, but do you really think that Egypt and the Saudis are going to try to use or put any leverage upon the administration in support of the Palestinians, or is this just more rhetoric and an echo chamber dialogue?
Well, what levers do they really have? I mean, no one takes them seriously in terms of the Arab street. The Egyptians don't have the ability to put any kind of leverage on the U.S. They are that government is still dependent on U.S. support. It has significant political opposition internally. That's why they have such a repressive reality in Egypt. The same thing with the Saudis. You just had a few thousand new troops being sent to Saudi Arabia to protect its quote-unquote security. These are two states that are going to, at some point, go along with the U.S. In fact, I argue that the plan wouldn't have been presented if the U.S. did not get some indications that beyond the initial sort of pretend opposition, that these states would, in fact, find a way to support it. So, no, there's no leverage here. This is game playing that is only going to exacerbate the situation in that part of the world and lead to what we know the immediate effect will be, and that is the dream of Netanyahu and the right wing in Israel, which is to basically annex the entire West Bank.
President Mahmoud Abbas rejected the plan. He said he refused to look at the plan or talk to Trump on the phone about it to avoid giving the president, the U.S. president, the ability to claim that Abbas had been consulted. Quote, Trump asked that I speak to him by phone, but I said no, and that he wants to send me a letter. And Abbas said, I refuse to receive it. This plan has been 3 years in the making, but it took the administration 3 years to put this foolishness together? Or has it really just taken them 3 years to find the right time to present it, with both Trump facing the impeachment trial and Netanyahu involved in another election and facing indictments? Do you really think that Jared Kushner has spent three thoughtful years putting this together? Or, again, this is the time they needed to present it?
Well, I think this was definitely the time they wanted to present it. And I do believe that there was some thought put toward it. The problem was that the conversations and the analysis and the construction of the plan was only with one side. They came to a conclusion that is the U.S. and the Israelis that there was a plan that they could put on the table that would seem on one level attractive to the Palestinian Authority, who they are hoping will come on board at some time. And that's what they put out. Now, to the position of Abbas, you know, he recognizes, like everyone else in the Palestinian Authority, that this plan, if they don't have a vigorous opposition, could spell the end of any legitimacy that the Palestinian Authority might still have. And believe me, that authority has eroded over the last few years. So they have to pretend to be in opposition. But, you know, if they can negotiate arrangements in which the Israelis won't still have complete and total access to the so-called Palestinian state, you know, there's some wiggle room there that you might find unfolding in the next few months between the Palestinians and the U.S. and Israel around this so-called plan.
Elaborate on that, and I'm glad that you brought this up, because that was really going to be the next place I wanted to go in asking the question, how much of Mahmoud Abbas's position is really for his domestic political consumption to strengthen a position that, from what I understand, many Palestinians have given up on the Palestine Authority. And to that point, how much of this is Abbas posturing for his own domestic political consumption?
I think most of it, 90%, 100% perhaps, that, you know, there is significant opposition to the Palestinian Authority as a consequence of the failure of the Oslo Accords, that many Palestinians see that the only thing that resulted from the Oslo Accords was the Palestinian Authority being used as a military security force to control Palestinians for Israel, and the creation of a Palestinian petty bourgeoisie that is in collaboration with the ongoing occupation. So this plan presented by Donald Trump, if the Palestinian Authority made any inclinations or any indications that they might be of support, that would be the end of the Palestinian authorities. Even at this point, they had to suspend their security arrangements with Israel because, you know, they cannot be seen as enforcing this plan and enforcing the expanded occupation, if you will, of the territory. So it is mainly domestic politics that's driving the Palestinian authorities.
So what has happened to people such as Dr. Hanan Ashwari and Arakat and those other negotiators? I haven't heard those names in Diana Bhutu. I haven't heard those names in a very long time.
Well, Arakat was on major outlets, right before the announcement of the plan, and right after, you know, making the argument that this was, you know, dead in the water. He also, I think, correctly said that this could spell the end of the Palestinian Authority. They saw very much that their interests were really being threatened by this plan, because they knew that it was going to pull the political rug from under their feet, if you will. So they've been quite vocal in their opposition. But understand this. These are the folks that represent the Palestinian ruling class, the Palestinian bourgeoisie, if you will.
And that's why I posed the question, because you mentioned them in your previous answer.
Yeah, they have been quite comfortable with this arrangement, even though, you know, they had to suffer some of the indignities other Palestinians suffer. But they have been quite comfortable and have benefited from the Oslo Accords. For many Palestinians, this is the complete straw that breaks the camel's back, if you will. And many people are saying that this is really a call to action, a call to intensify the resistance.
In terms of how this plays out in American domestic politics, you've got Senator Bernie Sanders saying that Netanyahu is a racist and saying that Trump's so-called peace deal doesn't come close and is only going to perpetuate the conflict, that it's unacceptable. What do you think, or do you think, that this type of dialogue from a Bernie Sanders adds any leverage on the American side?
Well, it only helps to put on the table where Sanders stands with this issue of Palestine and the ongoing occupation by the Israeli state. And interestingly enough, his statements went further than each and every one of the other Democrat candidates.
Mm-hmm.
The other candidates seem to be more concerned with just the fact that the Palestinians were not consulted. But Bernie talked about the occupation. You know, Bernie talked about in even more stronger terms about the settlements and the reality of an annexation taking place. So,
okay,
you know, in terms of domestic politics, we'll see in Iowa and New Hampshire pretty soon.
Ajamu Baraka, as always, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate your analysis. And as always, look forward to having you back.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you. All right, folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.